Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And just to be clear, you know, I've got Paul with us. Welcome back, Paul. And just to be clear, you know, the Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, he actually captures a lot of this stuff. But the very beginning of the convention, and as a matter of fact, I am going to tell you that, you know, they go well into a month, if not more, because remember, I mentioned already that the first sign of them creating the Constitution was actually an inlay to the Articles of Confederation. Do you remember my saying that, Paul? And you're probably muted. Paul's back now.
I'm back.
Okay, so it was, I believe, August. I forget. I have to look at the navigational pane, but it was sometime in August when they first laid it out, and there were, you know, like they were talking about Article 20 and so forth. So in other words, they didn't really start consolidating. And, you know, I'm amazed at how much they did and what they did and the amount of time that they had. But then again, these were really brilliant men who were, you know, I'll just say raised up to do this, you know, this along with a lot of other things, right? And so anyway, what's, I guess, the really amazing thing is that what they were able to accomplish with what little time was left of the time of the convention. Does that make sense? I mean, you know, it seemed like they were stuck in philosophical space. Do you remember what day it was that that Benjamin Franklin basically, you know, told the convention that they needed to engage in prayer every day?
I remember that being said. I don't remember when it was, but I bet I could find it.
Yeah, we could probably find, you know, the sparrow, you know, I'm sure if we just did a word search, because this is all in a Word document. When we post this up for you folks, you'll actually get this. I think it's a nice document because it's formatted and it's kind of laid out. We're highlighting what we're reading, so that way you can kind of go through and go, oh, okay, there we go. Anyway, so we kind of left off, if I remember correctly, in the middle of, who is this? Governor Randolph. So Governor Randolph was kind of, you know, standing up and he made a comment that really had, you know, I made this comment to some obstinate people that were using an ad hominem attack with me, you know, saying I was an advocate for the Constitutional Convention and so forth. And I mean, there was no basis to this. Just because I used the word convention and, you know, the Constitution and even a little c constitutional convention, little c, not the capital con, but nevertheless. I use the word imbecile because I called these folks, you know, what kind of imbeciles are you? I'm giving you all of this other justification, documentation, and so forth that supports my position. And you just keep saying the same thing, holding your little finger of judgment out at me like some little juvenile, you know, like some kid in kindergarten playground, you know, con. And I'm going, what a bunch of imbeciles. So I call these guys imbeciles. And the John Birch leader, or the Western Divisional leader, whatever, at the time, just absolutely took offense that I dare call these people imbeciles. And I go, wow, what? You know, you got to be kidding me. I would refer to Marines as imbeciles. You know, the Marine Corps is imbecilic. And, you know, and that's almost denigrating myself. But anyway, it's obviously that these men didn't get up and go fist to cuff or, you know, challenge him to a duel because they weren't that sensitive in these days. Right?
Okay.
Anyway, but they did actually have duels. I mean, when you actually impugned a person's character, but clearly, I think you used the word up here, imbecile, right? Imbecilic?
Who, me?
Yeah. Well, so Mr. Randolph was not scrupulous to the point of power. When the salvation of the Republic was at stake, it would be treason to our trust, in other words, the trust that they were given, not to propose what we found necessary. He painted in strong colors the imbecility of the existing Confederation and the danger of delaying a substantial reform. In other words, if those who wanted to keep the existing system, that was almost as good. I mean, you may have to imply it, but I think it was a direct implication that everybody in there that wanted to maintain the Confederation were imbeciles. Anyway, especially when the states had actually told them to do what was necessary in working with everybody else to fix these problems.
Okay.
Anyway, so do you remember where you left off?
I remember reading that part. Let me see. I didn't.
Okay, so I'll just finish this the last half of the paragraph here. Anybody the present moment is favorable. I mean, he's saying now is the time to strike. The present moment is favorable and is probably the last that will offer. The true question is whether we shall adhere to the federal plan or induce the national plan. The insufficiency of the former has been fully displayed by the trial already made. There are but two modes by which the end of a general government can be attained. The first is by coercion, as proposed by Mr. Pinckney's plan two, by real legislation, as proposed by the other plan. Coercion, he pronounced, to be impracticable, inexpensive, cruel to individuals. It tended also to habituate the instruments of it to shed blood and riots in the spoils of their fellow citizens, and consequently train them up for the service of ambition. It's like what we're dealing with today. We must resort, therefore, to a national legislation over individuals for which Congress are unfit to vest such power in them would be blending the legislative with the executive, contrary to the received maxim on this subject. If the union of these powers heretofore in Congress has been safe, it has been owing to the general impotency of that government. Congress are moreover not elected by the people, but by the legislatures, who retain even a power of recall. They have, therefore, no will of their own. They are mere diplomatic body and are always ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous?
I guess.
Ubiquitous?
No, it's not ubiquitous. O-B-S-E-Q, obsequious.
Oh, obsequious.
Obsequious. Okay, that's not an easy one for me. To the views of the state, who are always encroaching on the authority of the United States. A provision for harmony among the states, as in trade, naturalization, etc., for crushing rebellion. Okay, so that closes that out. So he then, the next paragraph, he says what? Go ahead.
Okay. The next paragraph, he says, whenever it may rear its crest, and for certain other general benefits must be made. The powers for these purposes can never be given to a body inadequate as Congress are in point of representation, elected in the mode in which they are, and possessing no more confidence than they do, for notwithstanding what has been said to the contrary, his own experience satisfied him that a rooted distrust of Congress pretty generally prevailed. A national government alone, properly constituted, will answer the purpose, and he begged it to be considered that the present is the last moment for establishing one. After this select experiment, the people will yield to despair. The committee rose and the House adjourned.
Okay, so on those comments, they finished and they started to go about their evening to have dinner and so forth, and you know, deal with this another day. And so the next thing, okay, so we actually had this, let's just call it friction. Let's call it, you know, the temperature was turned up.
Okay.
Right? And so people, you know, the word imbecile or imbecilic was thrown out, and, you know, people were, I'll just say the paradigms were truly at a challenged point.
Okay.
And I don't know if they were stressed to the point of anything else, but they were challenged. And so the next thing we read in the next day is Hamilton's plan. Now, this is going to take some time.
Okay.
And so, because if I remember correctly, this is several pages, but this is Hamilton's plan. Now, go ahead and let's pick it up with what Mr. Hamilton decides to start imparting.
Okay. Mr. Hamilton had been hitherto silent on the business before the convention, partly from respect to others whose superior abilities, age, and experience. I'm sorry, GR. Let me continue. Whose superior abilities, age, and experience rendered him unwilling to bring forward ideas dissimilar to theirs, and partly from his delicate situation with respect to his own state, to whose sentiments, as expressed by his colleagues, he could by no means accede. Do you have a moment to share with us what's going on between Hamilton and the state of New York?
Okay, so up to this point, Hamilton was instrumental in helping Madison get this convention.
Okay.
And so Hamilton was definitely an advocate. They were both, I don't know if they met at the Annapolis convention or if they met at a previous convention or when they met and how they met. I just know that they were together recommending significant changes to the Confederation. Okay. In the Annapolis convention, which basically they penned the language, you know, to do what's necessary to meet the exigencies of the Union. So at this point, I think that they were somewhat, and you got to remember, Thomas Jefferson's gone. Madison is, you know, exploring and has been expanding his, you know, his, I'll just say his network in connecting to people. And Hamilton was one who was equally literate and, I mean, was a good, I'll just say, if you want to call it sounding board or sparring partner regarding concepts. And, you know, if you've ever found somebody that really knows stuff that, you know, can kind of argue, you know, points and counterpoints and so forth with you or what have you. So I think that there was this, I don't want to call it a bromance, but I think that there was this, a kinship that really, you know, brought them together as partners in trying to create a national government.
Okay. All right. So here we go.
Okay.
Okay. So I think I just respected his own state, to whose sentiments as expressed by his colleagues, he could by no means exceed. The crisis, however, which now marked our affairs, was too serious to permit any scruples whatever to prevail over the duty imposed on every man to contribute his efforts for the public safety and happiness. He was obliged, therefore, to declare himself unfriendly to both plans. He was particularly opposed to that from New Jersey, being fully convinced that no amendment of the Confederation leaving the states in possession of their sovereignty could possibly answer the purpose. On the other hand, he confessed he was much discouraged by the amazing extent of country in expecting the desired blessings from any general sovereignty that could be substituted. As to the powers of the convention, he thought the doubts started on that subject had arisen from distinctions and reasonings too subtle. A federal government he conceived to mean an association of independent communities into one. Different confederacies have different powers and exercise them in different ways. In some instances, the powers are exercised over collective bodies, in others, over individuals. As the German Diet, and among them, and among ourselves in cases of piracy. Where's he going? The German diet and among ourselves in cases of piracy.
Yeah, so okay. Diet and I believe is a shorthand by him.
Okay, and it may be a German word, because as in diet,
right.
Not diet.
Right.
Okay. So all right, so I'm going to move on, but I think I understand.
Okay.
It's something other than
it was a shorthand, right? Okay.
Right. All right. Great latitude, therefore, must be given to the signification of the term. The plan last proposed departs itself from the federal idea as understood by some, since it is to operate eventually on individuals. He agreed, moreover, with the honorable gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Randolph, that we owed it to our country to do on this emergency whatever we should deem essential to its happiness. The states sent us here to provide for the exigencies of the Union, to rely on and propose, any plan not adequate to these exigencies, merely because it was not clearly within our powers, would be to sacrifice the means to the end. It may be said that the states cannot ratify a plan not within the purview of the article of the Confederation, providing for alterations and amendments. Now, here comes this argument again, GR. We've seen the state instructions, but this keeps coming up.
Right.
It keeps bringing this up.
Uh-huh. So,
right?
So the question is, you know, where were the sentiments, you know, in this convention, as well as during the ratification debates? There were people that really had, they were hell-bent, I'll just say it that way, in preserving the power of the state. They did not want, nor did they think, conceding to creating a more powerful general government to have a level of control over them that they were not willing to give up. And so I believe that there were people within the convention that actually were lending to anti-federalist paradigms. And so, because we already know that there were people that actually became hardcore anti-federalist in this convention.
Even though, GR, and we read these instructions from
yes,
the state.
Yes.
Even though every state wanted to do this, there are only a couple states that had some specific objections, but no one.
Well, there were specific points. The objections, so to be clear, the objections you talk about were very specific points that were identified by article. It wasn't some general point. Hey, we got this reservation in general. No, they were very specific. We do not want to let go of this, our equal suffrage.
Okay. So what happened is people got into the convention who were still personally felt tied to the Articles of Confederation.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, No.
Okay.
The ineptness of the Articles of Confederation, which empowered the states. Okay, so you got it. It's not like they're the people, these anti-federalists, not one anti-federalist stood up and said, the Articles of Confederation is the most supreme document ever.
Right.
I mean, that would be disingenuous. They would okay. all walk around the car and actually say, you know, it's like your friend coming over. When you think they're your friend, and all they do is they cut you down. Oh, this is a crappy car. It looks like it's going to be a lemon. It's, you know, it's a Ford found on road. I mean, they already have their biases. And
right.
My point is that those men, this persists throughout, you know, the generations and societies. We have those people okay. that are obstinate. And there were people that came in that were appointed by whom? Who appointed these men?
Well, the states did.
The state legislators, very specifically.
Right.
So we have to understand that there were going to be what we would see as anti-federalists in the small states because they did not want to give the big states any power. You better guard our equal suffrage. Because okay. I believe that was Connecticut that stated that. There were two states that actually had the reservations.
That was really important. They wanted to guard their equal suffrage. Yes. Now, it turns out that they wound up getting it. But they were charged to support that. Yeah. But I still see this roadblock being thrown up about. Yeah, and I think so. What you're saying is the real impetus is the states didn't want to lose their power. I think that's what was going on.
Well, there were people in this convention you broke away from reading because you go, what's going on, GR? How come this keeps coming up? There right. were people that were not going to let this go.
Okay.
But sure. over time, as they start, they constantly and persistently massaged, and these men ended up contributing. George Mason was a huge contributor, to the convention.
Okay.
And so you can't say, even though he was a huge anti-federalist, it wasn't, it's just imagine if we actually had Republic Review kickoff. Now, we're not talking about a constitutional convention. We're talking about, an audit by the states to actually pare down and actually force the federal government into compliance to the Constitution. And I can tell you that California will try to wield a bigger hand than they have as a state. They're, we're more popular. We should have five times the vote, five times the say, that kind of crap. And not only that, but they will say, we should have a government that gives us these things. They should be giving us welfare because they're all on board. And as a matter of fact, I see it go down this way, that they'll be obstinate. They will be not just obstinate, but they will try to inject and try to pervert and divert. And what will end up happening is the majority of the sane states, if we got all the states in the room, the majority would be the sane states. And we're only talking about 26, 27. We only need 27 states. Right. So with the 27 states that actually have the full enough control over Congress to force their congressmen. Now, let's think about this. When we're talking about Texas, Texas has Democratic congressmen. And they're saying, well, hold on here. That's not enough control. And I'm saying, absolutely, it is control, because once the state legislature crosses the line of saying we demand full compliance of the Constitution, any Democrat, Republican, any public servant that fails to fulfill their oath and ensure that the Constitution is complied with by, demolishing and dismantling the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, and all of these things that are clearly unconstitutional, that the states will have no problem unequivocally declaring that this must be disbanded and done away with and never to be picked up again unless an amendment be made.
Right.
And so what'll happen is if any Democrat is dumb enough, if they're a Democrat from Texas and they're dumb enough to think that I'm going to vote against this, when you have your state legislature, a mass majority of your state legislature demanding compliance, and you decide to defy them, they will actually have you recalled. And they will demand that you actually be removed and banned for life. They will actually pull Section 3 of the 14th Amendment on you, and they'll beat you down, and you'll never be a public servant again.
They will finally learn what Section 3 of the 14th Amendment
really means instead of what Congress is trying to make it to mean.
Right.
Right. Because it's not about trying to get people to uprise or trying to get people to take a stand on the Constitution. Section 3 is about an insurrection against the Constitution, not an insurrection. And it is not an insurrection when you stand up and you demand and you petition government to actually comply to the Constitution and point out that they're failing. That's not an insurrection. That's actually the right of petition for the redress of grievances. Anyway, we will be right back after this short promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now, obviously, we've covered 3/4 of a page, and Hamilton still hasn't even introduced a plan. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if you've noticed, Paul, but there tends to be today such an impatient people. You know, right. The people think that they're above everything. Give it to me in 30 seconds or less, or give me the 90-second elevator pitch. And, you know, who are we to believe? I understand time is very valuable, and I believe that there's lots of people that waste time. But I believe that a person that has created the paradigm, it's almost like, you know, when I write something, I don't have time to edit it, and I'm not the best editor, but I put it out in draft because I believe the content, the information is important. I'm making an argument. I'm providing information that nobody has ever shined light on before. And so my perspective is that any person, and I actually, I've had two different people come to me, two different excusers in reading my book or reading my stuff. And so one is, oh, well, I see an error and I am not going to waste my time reading something that has errors. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You know, you're obviously much greater than I, and apparently you're fixing all the problems, so we'll just follow you. Okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. And then I have the other paradigm of people that say, oh, well, you wrote this way over my head. I don't understand these words. You didn't dumb it down. I can't read this. And there's no desire to expand or extend oneself beyond the sixth grade education that one has. And I'm going, oh my gosh. I mean, I can't help you either. I mean, if you're not willing to try to help yourself, then I can't help you. And so there are those types of excuses, but my point and why I've digressed a little bit here is Hamilton here hasn't even gotten to the point of a plan yet.
Right.
Okay, and I mean, this is a pretty lengthy paragraph. Fortunately, there are some sentences here, right? It's not just one sentence, but as we've seen in other cases. But anyway, he goes on for the next page, 2 pages, 3 pages, 4 pages, and then, he comes to an end. Now, I would, suffer to think how people would have just said, hey, you know, can you wrap it up? Or say, you only have 2 minutes. To think that our county commissioners believe that they're so righteous that they can contain you to 2 minutes. Now, I get it if you're just complaining, you're just, if you're not really contributing. But if you're wanting to hold them to, to the Constitution and petition them, and they try to limit you, friends, What you have is tyranny because the law protects you and constrains them from being able to, what they call abridge, diminish or take away your time or tell you how to do it or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, okay, so go ahead. I'm sorry for the interruption, but okay, so here,
right.
He's still kind of talking in theory, but let's move forward.
So the next paragraph starts with a great question, correct?
That is correct.
All right. The great question is, what provision shall we make for the happiness of our country? He would first make a comparative examination of the two plans, prove that there were essential defects in both, and point out such changes as might render a national one efficacious. The great and essential principles necessary for the support of government are, 1, an active and constant interest in supporting it. That's a good point. This principle does not exist in the states in favor of the federal government. They have evidently, in a high degree, the esprit de corps. I've heard this a lot. What is esprit de corps?
Team.
Can you sum that up for us?
Yeah, it's all about the team. It's all about we, the state, the group, esprit de corps, us against them.
Okay. They constantly pursue internal interests adverse to those of the whole. They have their particular debts, their particular plans of finance, etc. All of these, when opposed to, invariably prevail over the requisitions and plans of Congress. 2, the love of power. Men love power. Well, Madison should know. The same remarks are applicable to this principle.
Now, did you mean Hamilton should know or Madison should know?
I apologize. I meant Hamilton should know.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Hamilton should know. The same remarks are applicable to this principle. The states have constantly shown a disposition rather to regain the powers delegated by them than to part with more or to give effect to what they had parted with. The ambition of their demagogues is known to hate the control of the general government. It may be remarked, too, that the citizens have not that anxiety to prevent a dissolution of the general government as of the particular governments. A dissolution of the latter would be fatal. Of the former would still leave the purposes of government attainable to a considerable degree. Consider what such a state as Virginia will be in a few years, a few compared with the life of nations. How strongly will it feel its importance and self-sufficiency? An habitual attachment of the people. Oh, I'm sorry. 3, an habitual attachment of the people. The whole force of this tie is on the side of the state government. Its sovereignty is immediately before the eyes of the people. Its protection is immediately enjoyed by them. From its hand, distributive justice and all those acts which familiarize and endear. Government to a people are dispensed to them. 4, force by which may be understood a coercion of laws or coercion of arms. Congress have not the former except in few cases. In particular states, this coercion is nearly sufficient, though he held it in most cases not entirely so. A certain portion of military force is absolutely necessary in large communities. Massachusetts is now feeling this necessity and making provision for it. But how can this force be exerted on the states collectively? It is impossible. It amounts to a war between the parties. Foreign powers also will not be idle spectators. They will interpose. The confusion will increase, and a dissolution of the Union ensue. 5. I want to make a remark about number 4.
Uh-huh.
Because what he's describing sounds like it's happening now, and not because, and I would say it's
it happened at the Civil War.
Say what?
It happened at the Civil War.
Okay.
Force. I mean, if you go through all of 4, force by which may be understood a coercion of laws or coercion of arms. Congress have not the former, except in a few cases. In particular states, this coercion is nearly sufficient, though he held it in most cases not entirely so. A certain portion of military force is absolutely necessary in large communities. Massachusetts is now feeling the necessity, because Massachusetts with the Shea Rebellion, and making provisions for it. But how can this force be exerted on the states collectively? It is impossible. It amounts to a war between the parties. Foreign powers also will not be idle spectators. They will interpose. The confusion will increase and a dissolution of the Union ensue. This is pretty much what really ended up happening with the Civil War, other than the fact that, because had Lincoln stayed the course and basically went the unconstitutional path, you can't leave the Union, we're not letting you, That actually was going to fail. He saw that failing. And what would have ended up happening, as basically what Hamilton just basically prescribed, that the Union would cease to be. Mm-hmm. And so Lincoln was driven to actually change it to actually become a singular issue, and that singular issue was over slavery.
Okay.
And so he changed the cause, which basically rallied, because many of the states, just, you know, some states were absolutely very fine with those states leaving.
Sure. So,
and at the same time, go ahead.
Right. In other words, he didn't start out with slavery.
He didn't. No, he didn't. And at the same time, there were foreign nations that were quickly interposing. You know, they were actually, you know, giving money, aid, and equipment and so forth to the southern states so that they could succeed.
Is there any documentation that you know of? There's someone I know that has documentation that not only that, but some southern plantation owners were in hock to Great Britain.
Well, so they were in hock as a state, as I understand it. Maybe they were in hock on their plantation because they were at that. But you got to remember, at that point in time, remember I told you, this is more deducing than speculation on my part, that there were certain plantations that were franchising themselves. And they were investing heavily in spreading slavery across these incoming states, into Missouri and so forth. And they were so vested into making sure that they could expand their franchise that I think they put themselves into some financial, you know, bad decisions, what have you, where they needed to basically take out loans.
Wow.
And so you got to remember, I forget whose book it was, but it was written in a book that identifies it. There was literally just about 900 owners of the plantations. Now, I don't mean it was just 900 separate plantations. There may have been the plantations and their sons. In other words, there was a very small select interest of people in the South that all voted to secede and basically, you know, leave the Union. It was a very defined minority of elitists that made that decision.
Right.
And it was a decision that was to suit them, not the South. And the majority of the people in the South were actually, I'm going to guess, if not the majority, almost the majority of the people were flabbergasted that they made this decision.
Mm.
And the concept was, and people kind of embrace this, that, you know, they're doing bad things and we're leaving the Union. You know, who are they to, you know, to do this? They're, you know, and I think they were able to persuade enough of the people to, you know, stand up and support Southern secession. But the desire to support Southern secession became marginal compared to stopping slavery. Why? Because a lot of people in the South didn't like slavery. They saw it as a problem. Most of the people in the South didn't have slaves.
Right.
Most of the people in the South were almost close to becoming slaves because they were so destitute and poor.
Wow.
And so they saw, you know, that slavery wasn't a good thing and that, you know, possibly the North winning, that might be a good thing. So see how things changed as the perceptions changed.
Yeah, well, one of the things that occurred to me is this point number four he makes. It seems like we're seeing a division today.
Oh, absolutely. You know, but tenfold in so many ways, right? Yeah. Right. He was a very smart man in understanding political theory. And so he was a theorist. And so, you know, he was always getting into political theories. And so he was a very well-read man. He was one of the most literate men. Hamilton and Madison were probably the two most literate men in America at the time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. I don't think I'd count out Franklin and Jefferson, but
So Jefferson didn't have time to read all of his books. Yeah. Jefferson had lots of books. He was buying lots of books. Madison would receive those books and read them. And so Jefferson didn't really read those books until he really became the sage, retiring after his presidency. That's when he finally had time to read them.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Right. Okay. Five, influence. He did not mean corruption, but a dispensation of those regular honors and emoluments which produce an attachment to the government. Almost all the weight of these is on the side of the states.
So let me ask you this. What's an emolument?
An emolument is a benefit you receive from being in government, as I understand.
Well, it's an emolument you receive from a government.
Yes.
Okay. So who today receives emoluments from government?
Oh, my goodness. Who doesn't?
There you go. So you see, because read this again. He's talking about the corruption, right? Read it again now.
Okay. So influence. He did not mean corruption, but a dispensation of those regular honors and emoluments, which produce an attachment to the government. Almost all the weight of these is on the side of the states. It must continue so as long as the states continue to exist. Let me stop there for a minute.
Uh-huh.
The point you made here is the emoluments attach you to government. It's like an attachment. It's like a dependence. It's like, so if people who are, I don't think it was ever their intention for people to permanently receive emoluments from government, except in the course of their official duties.
So one of the things I learned in the Marine Corps is, you know, you better be slow in creating an allotment because, you know, because in boot camp, we were being told, you know, because it's not like we were making a lot of money, but, you know, because I think I was bringing home somewhere around $200 a month.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I think I was bringing home somewhere around $200 a month.
And you lived on that?
Well, yeah. So actually, maybe it was $200 a payday. So maybe it was $400 a month. Yeah. Yeah, lived on that. I mean, my rent basically took up most of my money. So at that point in time, my wife had to work because I just could not, you know, provide completely for my family as I was married and in the military. Unlike today where, you know, they have gotten all sorts of benefits, but, you know, but that's completely changed because the people of old, those who have served, have never gotten the increase. So see what happens is as they increase or they decrease the value of money because they inflate it by increasing everybody's salary, they do not increase at the same tone and speed those who have basically been, if you want to call them discarded, retired, what have you, that aren't in that pay structure again. So you get left behind very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so, That's the design of the current system today. Most people are going to be crushed by inflation. I should say most patriots, most conservatives, most people of 60 years or 50 years and older. Mm-hmm. They are perceived as the threat to government today. So actually devaluing the money that they're getting is the plan, because then they become more dependent and they have to do what you tell them.
Right.
Right. So as we look at, you know, what he's talking about, these attachments and so forth, they become, you know, they become testaments to this addiction that, you know, it is not good to have the nation addicted, because that's how you can be extorted. That's how you can become coerced. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. Okay.
All right.
See, almost all the weight of these is on the side of the states and must continue so as long as the states continue to exist. All the passions, then, we see of avarice, ambition, interest, which govern most individuals and all public bodies, fall into the current of the states and do not flow in the stream of the general government. The former, therefore, will generally be an overmatch for the general government and render any confederacy in its very nature precarious. Theory is, in this case, fully confirmed by experience. The Amphictyonic Council. I'm guessing we may not know what that is. I'll look that up.
Yeah, it's a historic council that happened. Yeah, I don't remember what it was, but I'll look it up. Go on.
Okay, the Amphictyonic Council had, it would seem, ample powers for general purposes. It had, in particular, the power of fining and using force against delinquent members. What was the consequence? Their decrees were mere signals of war. The Phocian king, I think he might mean Phoenician king,
uh-huh.
of war.
Uh-huh.
The Phoenician war is a striking example of it. Philip, at length, taking advantage of their disunion and insinuating himself into their councils, made himself master of their fortunes.
Yeah, so the Amphictyonic Council, that was ancient Greece.
Okay.
All
right. The German Confederacy affords another lesson. The authority of Charlemagne seemed to be as great as could be necessary. The great feudal chiefs, however, exercising their local sovereignty, soon felt the spirit and found the means of encroachment, which reduced the imperial authority to a nominal sovereignty. I think this is the German thing. The Diet.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay. The Diet has succeeded, which, though aided by a prince at its head, of great authority independently of his imperial attributes, is a striking illustration of the weakness of confederated governments. Okay, other examples instruct us in the same truth. The Swiss cantons have scarce any union at all, and have been more than once at war with one another. How then are all these evils to be avoided? Only by such a complete sovereignty in the general government as will turn all the strong principles and passions above mentioned on its side. So he's now making clear where even though he hasn't set a plan.
Yep.
Hamilton.
Yes.
Is an advocate of a strong general government.
Yes, big time. Yep.
Okay.
Right. Him and Madison were working together, like I said, in Annapolis and so forth. And he, by the alleged spy that he allegedly was, it kind of lends to some of the things he rears here in this particular speech. Keep going.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. Does the scheme of New Jersey produce this effect? Does it afford any substantial remedy whatever? On the contrary, it labors under great defects, and the defect of some of its provisions will destroy the efficacy of others. It gives a direct revenue to Congress, but this will not be sufficient. The balance can only be supplied by requisitions, which experience proves cannot be relied on. If states are to deliberate on the mode, they will also deliberate on the object of the supplies and will grant or not grant as they approve or disapprove of it. The delinquency of one will invite and countenance it in others. Quotas, too, must in the nature of things be so unequal as to produce the same evil. To what standard will you resort? Land is a fallacious one. Compare Holland with Russia, France or England with other countries in Europe, Pennsylvania with North Carolina. Will the relative pecuniary abilities in those instances correspond with the relative value of land? Take numbers of inhabitants for the rule and make a like comparison of different countries, and you will find it to be equally unjust. The different degrees of industry and improvement in different countries render the first object a precarious measure of wealth. Much depends, too, on situation. Kant, let's see, what's this abbreviation? Kant, New Jersey, and
maybe
North,
Connecticut? Oh. Connecticut?
Huh? Oh, Connecticut, New Jersey, and North Carolina not being commercial states and contributing to the wealth of the commercial ones can never bear quotas assessed by the ordinary rules of proportion.
Interesting.
They will and must fail in their duty. Their example will be followed, and the union itself will be dissolved. Whence, then, is the national revenue to be drawn? From commerce? Even from exports, which, notwithstanding the common opinion, are fit objects of moderate taxation from excise, etc., etc. These, though not equal, are less unequal than quotas. Another destructive ingredient in the plan is that equality of suffrage, which is so much desired by the small states. It is not in human nature that Virginia and the large states should consent to it, or if they did, that they should long abide by it. It shocks too much the ideas of justice and every human feeling. Bad principles in a government, though slow, are sure in their operation and will gradually destroy it. A doubt has been raised whether Congress at present have a right to keep ships or troops in time of peace. He leans to the negative. Mr. P's plan provides no remedy. If the powers proposed were adequate, the organization of Congress is such that it can be properly and effectually exercised. He keeps going and
yeah, he does. Okay, so we do have less than a minute, right? So I'm glad you caught that. Okay, so here, Hamilton is really going through a lot of, and I think he's exposing a lot of truths. And so I don't think that there's anybody in that room that can actually stand up and deny what he's stating here. And so this is a pretty powerful commentary. However, he exposes himself as he goes on and talks about a permanent executive, where, you know, instead of having 4 years or what have you, it becomes a lifelong position. In other words, you know, a king. And so that becomes a signal to the others that, you know, hey, this guy is, you know, I'll use the word, he is, you know, Francophile. What is the... it's the opposite of the Francophile, Anglophile. He is an Anglophile, and he prefers their king. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. We'll be back with more of this.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.